Natural Resources Committee meeting for Tuesday, January 30th, 2007. You will note that we have a quorum of both chambers. And
sorry, Mr. Chair. I'll get Senator Nelson to try to send you home.
And that we will move on to our first item on the agenda, which is a federal grant request to the Department of Agriculture. Ms. Koba, please come forward and bring anyone you would like with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good morning. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. We are before you this morning with what we hope is a very straightforward request. We're requesting approval to apply for a federal grant in the amount of $292,400. This is a grant within the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Services, known as the Conservation Innovation Grant Program. And in essence, what we are doing is, with our ongoing efforts in fighting Phytophthora morum, commonly known as sudden oak death disease in the nursery sector, we want to begin a creative nursery-based inspection program. And I had mentioned this to you in our overview as we look at how we do inspections in our agency and seeing what's kind of the push at the national level, moving more towards an audit-based inspection so that the industry itself is putting protocols and processes in place to try to minimize the occurrence of this disease, hopefully not have it occur at all. And then the department plays the role of coming in and monitoring their inspection processes, doing audit-based work to make sure what they're doing is actually successful. And in that way, hopefully reducing costs to the industry from a department-based inspection program. To our knowledge, this would be the first attempt to create such a program in the nursery industry in the United States. We've been working closely with USDA on this concept, and the grant would be matched 25% with cash from the industry itself and then 25% in-kind contribution from the department staff and OSU staff. The grant is due February 2nd, and if we're lucky, we would expect to receive it this fall and begin implementing the program this fall. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I also have the real expert on staff, Nancy Osterbauer, is our plant pathologist, if you had any real technical questions about this effort.
Representative Barron.
I don't think this is technical, J.D., but it says here that you may have to come back in 2008. Could you tell me what that means, how much money you would be coming back and asking for at that time?
Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we would need to come back to get federal funds limitation. It wouldn't be additional federal funds. We work closely with legislative fiscal and monitor our limitation, and if we're getting close to the point where we've used it and we need additional limitation, we would have to come back to the E-Board and get that limitation.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
I have just a quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Katie. Could you, since I'm not familiar with what the federal says here, that that the sudden death occurrence happened despite a rigorous testing program that exceeds federal requirements. So could you just very briefly explain what are the federal requirements and then how this will work with that? And then also I'm assuming that the costs for your staff to administer or assist with this program are already in your budget.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. We first discovered sudden oak death in Oregon 2003. It is occurring in the wild in Curry County, and then we began surveying nurseries and found it in nursery stock. And we have found it in Washington, Oregon, and California. And in early 2004, the federal government implemented, which is basically a quarantine on our three states, and required certain kinds of inspections of nursery plant to be done before the plants could leave the three states. In Oregon, we have had a more aggressive inspection program than that federal minimum to try to maintain market assurance for our products. We were hopeful last year that after a couple years working with the industry that we wouldn't find it, and we're still finding it. We still believe that we can keep it out of the industry, and so we're looking to figure out the next steps in terms of being aggressive in dealing with this disease and keeping it out of the nursery sector in Oregon. In terms of our staff funding, it is our ongoing budget. We're not asking for any additional resources for our staff.
Follow-up to that. As far as infestation, is it occurring? I mean, is it transferring from wild oaks to the nursery stock? Is that what you're seeing? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I think I'll let Nancy just visit with you a little bit about
it.
This is her first time, so be kind to her.
We are always kind, isn't it?
Staff in training.
Please let
her find us. Hi, my name is Nancy. I start with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Chair Devlin and Representative Dingfelder, to answer your question, that is happening in California, where it is moving from. They have a very large infestation in California around the San Francisco Bay Area. 14 counties are infested. They've lost hundreds of thousands of trees. And nurseries within that area are seeing the disease coming from the wild into their nurseries. In Europe and other places, they have seen it move from nursery stock into the wild. So that's what, I mean, that's what our concern is, and that's what our customers' concern is back east, is that if we're shipping infected stock, they'll plant it in the wild, and it will get into their eastern hardwood forests and devastate their oaks. We have not seen that yet. We haven't seen it in Oregon move from nursery stock into the wild, but we don't have any nurseries around our infestations in Curry County, but it's a possibility.
Does budget management
now. Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend that you approve this request.
Mrs. List, this is a public hearing. I believe there's no one else that wants to testify.
I propose also recommending approval of the request to submit the application.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Okay, it's been moved to approve the request. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard, since you asked the first question, if you're on the poll, will you carry it to the poll?
I will, Mr. Chair. That'll teach me to ask.
Working on the poll.
Right.
Okay, we'll move on to the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Committee, I believe we left off at KTM 4 in your binders. And we will just go ahead and get started as soon as technology gets up to pace with us.
Good morning, committee. While we're getting technology up to pace, we'll do some introductions here. My name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And you are correct that we left off at key performance measure 4, which is hazard awareness. And maybe the folks that are with me up here want to introduce themselves.
Ms. McConnell, just for the sake of, I don't know if I said it properly on the record. I think I just invited you up here. So for the record, I'll find it here. I open a hearing on SB 5514, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Since we're no longer in overviews, we're actually in consideration of the bill. So just for the record.
Thank you, Chair.
For the record, my name is Don Lewis. I'm the Assistant Director of the Geological Survey and Services. And it looks like the technology has almost caught up with us. We've lost our screen here.
Need that.
Thank you.
So just to, Chair, just to recap while we're getting screens to talk to each other here, we had presented the overview on Thursday. We had discussed with you some of our budget challenges and drivers and some of the schemes and ideas we have for efficiencies and for reductions. And we're going through our performance measures, how we had scheduled this or presentation was to actually move through the performance measures as they relate to the two programs that we have, which is the Geologic Survey and Services and our Mineral Lands Regulation and Reclamation. And we had moved through most of them. We were on hazard awareness is where we stopped, and so we'll pick up there and finish this part and then talk a little bit, summarize the rest of the budget and then go into the LIDAR primer, which is what we know you've all been waiting for.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, performance measure 4 is a performance measure that's sort of a grab bag of activity that the agency is involved with. Basically, it characterizes public hazard awareness in Oregon. And one of the things, and basically what it asks us to do, is to assess the degree of hazard awareness and the public's interaction with the agency in that regard. And so we've struggled with this over time, and basically we feel that this is far too qualitative a performance measure. So we're looking at how do we make it more quantitative. In our opinion, the public is basically reaching what's effectively a saturation level of awareness of hazards. This and other list of things that are constantly in the media and people are asking us questions about. And so what I'd like to share with you, I suppose, is what we're experiencing and what we can measure in terms of activity on our website in this regard. Our website is like others in the state. That's just a depiction of it as of Friday. Some of the things that are available on the web, you can download these various publications. You happen to have the publication on the far right. That's our most recent issue at Cascadia. It happens to be dealing with LIDAR. And we have some freeware that allows us to track activity of where people are visiting our webpage, what they're looking at, what is the search string that they're using to access and search on our website. And we notice that there are peaks and troughs, if you like, at various times. And this is as of last, this is shortly after we started doing this. This is a depiction as of August 3rd of last year, in 2006. There happened to be a fairly significant earthquake, low-level earthquake up in Washington State, just north of Portland, about 20 miles north of Portland. And immediately that evening, we saw peaks on our website, and again, focused on pages that we describe as being earthquake-related. You see this rose color here surges up, and also our publications, certainly related, we believe related to that same seismic event, surged that day and the following day. We lost data here because we were only using a counter that maxed out. We've since increased that counter to able to handle the traffic. And you can see that we average about 1,000 page loads a day, and it doubles during certain days during these kind of events. We see this, and we've seen it again repeatedly on other earthquakes, and sometimes it occurs for reasons that we don't quite understand. In January this year, we had a tremendous surge, again, a doubling of activity, and we found out it was related to sunstones. As it turns out, the Discovery Channel ran a program that evening, and immediately people from around the country started searching around and found our website and downloaded a variety of information. Same thing happened a few days ago related to debris flows. There weren't any significant debris flows. We couldn't find television programs. But for some reason, a whole group of people suddenly wanted to know about debris flows, came to our website, and downloaded information. So it's just an example of the experimenting we're doing to try to turn this into a more quantitative performance measure. We don't have the solution yet, but we're still working on it. Now, changing gears significantly, we have two performance measures that are related to Program 2, which is mine land reclamation, regulation and reclamation. The first performance measure, number 5, is related to cumulative acres of reclamation, area that's been returned to secondary beneficial use. And the purpose of this chart is to demonstrate that we're requesting a clarification of the target level that's most appropriate for the measure. In recent years, there's a bit of a surge in reclamation activity, and that resulted in these targets being created that are the current targets, averaging close to 500 acres a year as being projected out into the future. You can see that that's the slope right here. The long-term average, given what we know was the data back in the late 80s, early 90s, got a little bit of a gap here in terms of my record keeping. But this data is real, and this data is real. We've returned to the average of around 150 so acres a year. So basically, we're making a request that the target level be returned to the long-term average. And basically, it's not something that the agency is in control of in terms of cumulative acres. It's something that occurs, and we track over time. Performance measure 8.
Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, back to number 6. What caused your 2003 targets to be so out of whack?
What caused the targets, Chair Devlin and Representative Girard, to be so out? You mean that there were so much, apparently so much reclaimed in that year?
Yes.
I can't answer that directly. I could certainly find that out and get back to you.
I can make a guess.
Could I bring someone else up to quickly make a comment?
And we'll probably go to questions after the presentation, but have him come forward and make a comment on this. I just saw a perplexing look over on this side, so I thought I should...
I apologize.
I have the same question, so...
Because I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Gary Lynch, and I'm the Assistant Director for DAGAMI, and I'm the Administrator of the Mineral Land Regulation Reclamation Program. I suspect what we're seeing here is a number of factors. One is partly due, I think, to the consolidation to some degree of the industry, and that bigger companies, a number of bigger companies have moved into Oregon, and what we saw is some of these smaller sites in those areas aren't as competitive as they used to be, and so they reclaimed and get out of the business. Overall, what that spike really, there's a number of factors that may be part of this. One, we did a major revision of our bonding calculations, and we increased the bond load significantly. We went from like $5 million to $20 million. So the cost of doing business, frankly, got more expensive for some operators, and I think that may be a reflection in here. But I think there's probably a couple other things as well, and we really haven't made an analysis of it. So what we see is we've gone back to where we were back in the early 80s to early 90s. We have a data gap, which reflects the way our computer system worked. We just weren't tracking it as well as we should have or could have. And we're now back to the slope that has been consistent over the long haul. So that's the best I can do on that without off the top of my weak head.
Thank you very much.
Performance measure 8 is a measure of the operators with active sites who are inspected annually by MLRR staff. The intent of the program is to measure every operator with active sites every biennium. The production varies. There's a production cycle to it. It may or may not represent a lag with other economic activity in the state. And this is the physical distribution of the sites that have been visited over the last 3 fiscal years. The measure that we're talking about here basically would be the combination of, or the last year that we reported, in July of this year, of 2006, is the number of operators. There's 515 operators with active sites. Just under half of them were visited, but the trend line is to visit basically half of them every year. In other words, all of them, each biennium. And we believe that that should be the, and it is our internal target. We don't understand how the targets were showing a cumulative increase of 5% per year up to 75%, 80% and climbing. That isn't the intent. There is not the staff to do that. So we request getting back online again with the program, which is to visit every active site each biennium, or 50% each year.
Chair Devlin and committee members, one thing to note on this as well, this is, there are 515 operators. There are actually more sites than that, but we're looking at visiting the operators, not every, so that's a clarification on that as well.
In addition, this measure does not capture operators with inactive sites or exempt operators. The department does work with those parties as well. However, that is not captured in this data.
And I wanted to spend just a few minutes with our performance measures to illustrate how we use them, not just to track, to collect these data and track our activity, but how we actually use those for administrative and managerial decisions. And I just want to use a few illustrations of that. The first one here, the first one that we have is our performance measure results and changes. And this is from the customer satisfaction survey. This year is the first year that we've collected data on that. And we, being all the agencies in the state, have been requested to now include a customer satisfaction survey. And we have standard questions. You saw an analysis of the questions and the percentages of our returns from yesterday. I just wanted to make a couple of comments on this one. Is internally, we have a couple. It's the first year. Again, this is what it looks like if you're just looking at the chart of these six or these five categories that you are supposed to ask questions on, and then the sixth one, the availability. You have an overall, and then you have the five categories. We ask for our target to remain at 90%, even though we're reflecting these 95 and 90, our A pluses, our A's and our A pluses. And the reason we did that is because overall, and this is for the agency, this is not for either program, this is for the agency, so it's cumulative. Overall, we only had a 17% response rate this first time. And so that's low for statistics. We feel we need to improve our customer surveying capability before we come back and really start bragging about how good we are. We can just infer to it right now that we are hitting the targets on that. So we're going to be working on several other schemes and ways of collecting more customer satisfaction survey. And that is difficult for us. For our survey program, for geologic survey program, we have other agencies. We have a very diverse group that we serve. And so it's difficult to capture their input at times. The second thing is that we certainly would be open to any suggestions on ways that you would have or ideas on collecting customer satisfaction surveys or collecting those data. This is looking at a key performance measure where it reflects a strategic administrative decision that we made this year. This, again, is the tsunami evacuation brochures, and we showed that we were quite a ways over target over the last couple of years, and that really reflects us redirecting some of our efforts and funds toward printing 210,000 extra of these evacuation brochures in response to the Sumatra tsunami and earthquake, because there was a huge sensitivity of folks to those that type of activity. And so we took advantage of that, had printed up these evacuation brochures, distributed them to the communities on the coast so that they had something. People are willing, they're very interested and willing to look at that information at that time. We use this to critically evaluate our programs in our earthquake and landslide hazard completion. Mr. Lewis talked about how we are suggesting that we re-optimize our targets on this. If you looked at this, you may say, well, we're just doing dismally in this particular program, and let's look at it as the glass half full instead of the glass half empty here. And what it does is allow us to identify what is it that we need to be able to accomplish our goals. And we certainly identified that we need these LIDAR data, and Mr. Lewis explained that yesterday, to be able to do the landslide work in particular.
And we need to be able to devote full-time staff to this program. Right now we have one staff, one geotech staff, and he is on several other projects as well. Tsunami inundation maps, the same thing here. Without being able to collect those LIDAR and bathymetry data, we will limp along at one map a year or possibly a biennium. We will not be able to accelerate this program. We have been, and you will see in your public testimony there is a suggestion from the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness to increase that program to be able to accelerate it. And with that, I really want to go into talking about the LIDAR.
Before you do that, I'm going to go to about 5 minutes.
Okay.
So, Representative Perlman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, what is bathymetry? What is that information?
Senator Devlin and Representative Burley, bathymetry is the bare earth of the seafloor, if you want to say so. Bathymetry is topographic information on the seafloor. So we have topography for elevation information if you're looking at the continent, and then bathymetry is the same, and it's usually collected through sonar.
Thank you.
There's no questions. Seeing none, before you go into LIDAR, though, I would ask a couple of things in this presentation. One, that you talk a little bit about, you've made a reference before about how it's potentially funded. You made a reference before in terms of staff support for it. And can you try to explain those issues too in your presentation?
Chair Devlin and committee members, that is part of the presentation, both what we had recommended, what's in the governor's budget, and what we make as some recommendations now on that. One other thing quickly before we launch into the LIDAR, I would be remiss if I did not mention that we do have the potential for one legislative bill that would that has not been introduced yet, but possibly would have physical impact on the agency, and that is a bill that we are working with Representative Hunt's office to introduce that would do a considerable bit of housekeeping to our oil and gas drilling and exploratory program, and also restructure the fees again to get the fees back on balance to pay for that, to more fully pay for that program. As I explained yesterday, we've had, for us, it's a modest amount of additional work for the state, but for us, with a very small staff designation to that program, the coal bed methane work that has been occurring in Coos Bay has really put quite a strain on us. And so we have talked to the industry. We have stakeholder support from all of the major gas-producing companies in the state. And so we'll be moving forward with that. So I just wanted to let everyone know that would certainly have a physical impact on that particular program. Thank you. What we're going to do now is go through this one, Package 103, the statewide LIDAR policy option package. And so I want to do a little bit of introduction here, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Lewis to talk about what we've been doing. Actually, what LIDAR is. This is just really an introduction of the package now. Now, LIDAR is LI, light detection and ranging. So you'll hear that a little more, but that's where they came up with this clever acronym for it. It's a remote sense technology that we've been using since about 2004, since we've available, since we've known that it's become available in little postage stamps around it. I believe Oregon City and Clackamas County were some of the original places in the state that actually collected the LIDAR data on their own. Went forward with a model that was brought forth by the state of Washington, and particularly in the Seattle and Puget Sound area. They've been collecting LIDAR up there for several years. And they started what was called the Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium, and it is a group of federal, state, and city and county governances that pooled their funds together to be able to collect more for less. And again, you'll see the economies of scale of being able to collect this this data and wider swaths. We started a consortium here in 2004. This year, we have now leveraged about $50,000 of our money in staff time to and actually we closed the door yesterday. We now have $1 million in funds toward collecting LIDAR for this 2007 flight. That's federal, state agency, city, and county funding. So that's going to get that will be about 2,200 square miles of LIDAR data that will be collected. So this is outside of this package we're asking for, because we're moving ahead. We need these data now, so we're moving ahead anyway. Our package is saying, let's do this all together at one time as a statewide effort and not have to go with these postage stamps all the time. So initially we requested in our agency budget request $4.5 million. That'd be $4.3 million for the data collection of about 10,000 square miles, and that's this LIDAR area, which if you recall from yesterday, that's that area that we identify from our performance measures as where we spend most of our time dealing with issues. We also asked for one FTE, which would be about a $140,000 general fund for that, and then $45,000 in software and hardware, because it's data rich, shall we say. So we would need the material for that. That one's just a repeat. Now, specifically this package is linked to several key performance measures, and we've mentioned them before. Earthquake and landslide mapping, coastal erosion, detailed geologic mapping, our tsunami inundation mapping, and then indirectly into, of course, those tsunami evacuation and our hazard awareness. So this is a key efficiency and a key policy package for our agency. Now I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Lewis, and he's going to walk you through what LIDAR is and isn't, and who uses it beside us, and why we think it should be a statewide policy and not just something that we, Dogami, takes and keeps to ourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives and Senators. The LIDAR, again, is light detection and ranging. It's a technology that's, if you like, you could compare it to radar, which uses radio waves, but here we're using lasers. It's basically acquired from fixed-wing aircraft flying a couple thousand feet off the ground with a laser pulse scanner scanning about 100,000 cycles a second, measuring the return time of these pulses of light to the aircraft in fractions of nanoseconds. So it's only possible because of recent advances in a whole series of technologies related to the pitch and attitude of the aircraft, GPS base stations and satellite technology, as well as the processing capability of being able to process these literally terabytes of data. What you're collecting are again, light bouncing off anything on the surface, whether it's a tree, a building, a house, the ground surface itself, and back to the aircraft. The advantage of that is that it delivers numerous sets of data related to that return time that I'm going to show you some examples of, and is really kind of captured in this first slide. Existing topographic maps was a federal program that was developed and executed in the 1950s through 60s, and it was a combination of art and science. Air photos, of course, are a plane flying around taking photographs of the surface, and it involves, and the difficulty is that you can't see through the trees. Of course, in Western Oregon in particular, we have lots of trees. So from our perspective, selfishly, in terms of looking at hazards, it's very difficult to look through the trees, and this is a technology that allows us to do that. For the forest industry, which is actually really driving this technology in the commercial sector, forest inventory practices, measurement, and forest practices and acquisition of forest lands are being driven by LIDAR. So most contractors are occupied with two things. They're either working for directly or indirectly for the forest industry, or they're working for federal and state agencies related to flood map modernization. So we're really just a spin-off of those applications, and I'm going to show you a list of other parties that are also using them. This image on the left is basically what you see. It's a three-dimensional perspective of what you'd see on if you process data on a topographic map. It's fuzzy. You get generalities of maybe there's some bumps and swales, and there's no detail. And certainly it's obsolete. Again, these things are 50 years obsolete. For example, the interstate system is not present on topographic maps. In the 80s, some of them were drawn on, but they were not drawn on involving changes in contours. They're not real. They're just lines on a page, like a photograph. Whereas with LIDAR, it's just science, it's just measurements, and it's accurate and precise. Topographic maps are only accurate and precise to about a 30-foot elevation change, whereas we're talking about 6 inches or less for LIDAR. So in terms of knowing where you are in space, there is really no comparison. I'm going to show you some examples of that. And it's fast and actually inexpensive. A list of some of the applications of LIDAR. These are all the contractor, Watershed Sciences, that will be doing this work this coming winter, provided this slide. It's an example of some of the work they do. And actually an environmental firm that specializes in the environmental field, in particular riparian and wetline restoration design. And in terms of some of the engineering applications related to highway and transmission line siting. However, the same data is used by all parties in different ways. Two sets of data primarily are collected. You get everything, in other words, everything the light bounces off, including tree tops, building tops, highways, overpasses, etc. Or through computer processing, you can get what's called the bare earth image, where you've virtually deforested the land, taken off buildings and overpasses, so you can see the detail of the ground surface. And that's what this lower image here is depicting. This is the bare surface of this particular piece of real estate. Here's the all returns, and this one's been color contoured by the height of vegetation, deviance from the ground surface. As you can see that the yellowish colors are the taller trees in this vicinity. And then, of course, you can overlay and drape onto that other things like, for example, photography.
Mr. Chair, yes. Can we ask questions now, or would you prefer we wait till after that?
We're actually looking fairly good for time. So if you have a question now, that would be fine. Representative Garrard.
Being an old Air Force radar operator.
How old, Representative?
God will get you for that.
It's okay.
Thank you. Do you have a problem with LIDAR, with anonymous propagation?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Do you have a problem with LIDAR with anonymous propagation?
I don't understand the term anonymous propagation.
You stopped using that term 40 years ago.
I started on that.
Sorry.
Are you referring to anomalies?
The problem with radar is that sometimes you will get reflections mm-hmm. in the air. From particles which will reflect back and distort the radar picture you're getting. I was curious as to whether this system has the same kind of difficulty.
Well, yes, there are difficulties like that. For example, the optimal time to fly is basically on a day like today. In terms of aircraft being able to control its position, even though it's done by instruments, of course, the pilot needs to be able to see. In terms of the instrumentation, there are reflections off dense fog, and so you can't fly in dense fog. You can actually fly at night, but it's dangerous, so people generally don't do that. The military does that.
Well, the military clocked a Greyhound bus at 40,000 feet one time because of anonymous propagation, so... Well, thank you very much for your explanation.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up to that?
Yes.
Is that because of the difficulty in flying in those conditions or because of the technology?
It's the technology.
Okay. Thank you.
So generally, again, we hope that our contractor has been flying this week, and these are the kind of conditions you like. Also, in terms of optimizing the bare earth measurement, you need to fly in the late winter. So basically, the leaves are off. You're going to get the most penetration through the forest canopy when the leaves are off, as opposed to late summer, which would be the worst time possible from our perspective. Now I'm going to show you, you don't have these slides, however, they are images in the Cascadia that you do have in your binder, a series of slides of Tryon Creek State Park, basically just illustrating the effects of these different pieces of information and what the difference between topographic maps and their limitations and LIDAR and its benefits. So you're probably all familiar with Tryon Creek Park. The orientation you're going to see is from Highway 43 in Lake Oswego across to Highway 5, and you can't actually see the laser pointer on my screen. I'll point over there. There's a limitation on the technology. Here's an air photo from 2005 of Fruit State Park. The reason I'm showing it is it's a very densely vegetated piece of real estate. And it has various features of it. You know, we've got a drainage, series of drainage here, it's a complex drainage. We've got roads, we've got Dunthorpe in southwest Portland, we've got portions of Lake Oswego here. And if we were to look at this with just a topographic map, and some of you may be familiar with that, you know, here's what a typical, this is the same scale, all these images are the same scale of the exact same locations. Here's a topographic map that was actually made from data collected in 1961. You can't see it too well, but basically these roads and these houses were present in 1961. And this is actually, you can't see it too well in the projection, but these are a purpley color. These were buildings that were added in an update on this map in 1981. There's been no update since, so basically anything that's happened since 1961 in terms of roads or any other infrastructure development will not be present on the map. You can also see that, again, we've got a drainage system here with certain incised gullies. In other words, a typical drainage pattern in Oregon. One of the things we discover, because of the precision of LIDAR, is that virtually every topographic map has numerous errors in terms of the position of the stream, its slope angle, its gradient, whether or not the stream connects with how many connections there are to a major drainage, their location in space. Errors are everywhere. Again, it's a combination of art and science. Now, so this was what was available to the public and to users over the last several decades. But in the early 90s, the United States Geological Survey created what's known as a digital elevation model of that topographic data. And, of course, you get what you put in. We put in these contour maps that had, you know, general contour lines on them, and we get a general product out. And this is what everyone is relying on around the country. You can see that it's fuzzy. There is no greater detail in this unless you've got ground-based survey, which is very expensive, or something like LIDAR. And now as I toggle through these next pictures, I want to sort of keep your eye on, this is the parking area at Tryon Creek State Park itself. Keep your eye on sort of this area here, just south of Terwilliger Boulevard, and compare some of the images that you're going to see of what we have currently to work with versus what LIDAR delivers. So here's the all returns data, again, from LIDAR. You can see that trees, it doesn't look as dense because this is late winter conditions. In Tryon Creek, we've got some gullies and things going on here. Again, this is the area I'm asking you to look at. I'm going to go backwards before I go forwards. Now here's the bare earth. You can see that in reality, and this is depicting reality, within 6 inches or so, in terms of its vertical location in space, these gullies, this is completely missed in the topographic maps, and therefore that information is not present in any way you want to assess that, whether you're dealing with urban development issues, whether you're in a forested area and it's a forestry company wanting to build roads. They actually would have no idea that this is the detail that they're going to be facing in terms of the issues that they may be concerned with. Also, you can see, just sort of glancing at it, there's a tremendous amount of detail. When you zoom in here, and I don't have those slides today, perhaps at a later date if you're interested, we can expand on this to show you increased resolution. You can see individual pads. These are the pads that houses are sitting on, or apartment complexes. The roads themselves. You can build three-dimensional cross-sections in any direction that you want from this information. It's information that can be interrogated. It's not just a photograph. And here's sort of the final clincher, if you like, of measuring the difference between all returns and the bare earth. So you sort of got an instant inventory of tree cover in this particular map area. What's being highlighted here happens to be trees over 100 feet tall. By measurement, you can actually tell that the very tallest tree in this forest is 201.8 feet tall, plus or minus 6 inches, and it's located right here. The city of Portland actually went back in and did ground-based surveying and found out that these relative accuracies are, in fact, what they encountered in the field. They found that the individual trees that they're mapping in LIDAR, they found on the ground in the field, located within 2 foot accuracy laterally, and again, less than 6 inches vertically in terms of their dimensions. And this is what has the forest industry so excited, and in fact, the environmental interests around the world as well are sort of equally vying for, you know, how do we use this information? What is it good for? How can you interrogate it? You can, in fact, look at in between the ground and the surface canopy and interrogate the returns for the brush underneath the canopy. That's beyond our expertise, so we're not going to get into that today. Costs. LIDAR is, from a certain perspective, dirt cheap. Basically, this is the real contract rates that are part of our existing contract with this contractor, Watershed Sciences, that's working for the Puget Sound LIDAR Consortium. And these are the rates they charge in their contract based on the contiguous area that they're being asked to fly. So the smaller the area, the higher the unit cost, you know, approaching $1,000 a square mile. If you stitch together at least 250 square miles, that rate goes down to $430 a square mile, or 67 cents an acre. That's actually comparable to orthophotography and contour mapping costs for just a picture. So what we've been doing is been sharing this, and oh, by the way, for the area that we're requesting, the 10,000 square mile area that we've recommended the state consider, the variance between all the communities and cities and counties and agencies stitching all the ground together independently versus the cost of doing it collectively, all told, you would save $4 million by doing it all at once as opposed to independently. And the contractors, of course, aren't going to share this with you. Oregon City acquired their data. They felt that they were getting an absolutely fabulous deal, and they paid around $760 a square mile. We're now adding on to them at just over half that cost. So over this last winter, basically we've taken this idea of what is LIDAR, what it can be used for. We've gone around, and I couldn't even tell you how many presentations a couple of us have made. But we've built this consortium, and yes, there is significant federal interest, predominantly with the various divisions of the United States Geological Survey. And believe it or not, these various parts of that survey don't necessarily work together very well. So it's sort of a unique and positive experience to actually get them all to contribute monies to this program. And so we'll be flying this 2,000 square miles. And yesterday, ODOT requested that we add on the balance of Highway 26 here. And the City of Canby asked that we expand their area of interest. So that's how we're getting up over a little over 2,150 square miles. There's the parties, there's the area, and this is going to keep us busy over a very long time if we have the ability to fund the analysis of it.
I'll pick up here. Initially, what we came forward with for this package, for Package 103, the statewide LIDAR, was, as I said, we asked for $4.5 million, of which $4.3 million would be the actual data collection and cost of seeing, and the rest was for staff and SNS support. Governor's recommended budget assigns $4.3 million, which would be the data collection and processing, to a certificate of participation for funding, and we do not have any FTE support. We do have the $45,000. Is that general fund? Is it general fund?
No, that's in the...
Okay, so there's no general fund at this point recommended for this package. We would like to suggest a couple of things. Number one, the efficiency of what we just suggested or just showed that we would actually have for the benefit cost of collecting the statewide LIDAR, the 10,000 square miles, the $4 million savings, will be eaten up with interest and paying back of the COP, because that would be over, I believe it's over five biennia. Lisa, I'm pretty sure this was suggested as a five biennia payback. Therefore, the interest on that and the debt service would end up costing considerable. I do not have the exact number on that. It's probably not $4 million, but it's going to cut into that cost saving. We would be coming back if we take on this certificate of participation. We, the agency, would be coming back asking for that debt service in general fund each time, because it's simply something our agency couldn't absorb. So, and I think you've all seen our budget. There, if we had to pay the debt service, then we'd essentially have to close down our doors and simply pay the debt service. We asked for the FTE for a staff person to be able to administer this program. As you can see with that consortia, it's not an insignificant task to be able to herd all those cats together and get the RFP out and be able to keep this and the data collection and develop the processing and the QAQC. So it's really something that we would like to suggest that whomever takes this will need staff to ensure that it's done properly and on time. We strongly recommend that it be turned into full general fund financing and that the FTE be reinstated in that. Now, that said, do we have another on this? I was just talking about the viewer. That said, there are other ways that we may be able to do this. Maybe we could look at some staffing and some general fund seed money to continue with the consortia. That would be, instead of asking for the entire thing, it could be a challenge grant system. That's something to think about. There has been, you know, I'll be honest, there have been discussions that maybe it should be moved out of our program, out of our program, and moved somewhere else within the state agencies. We've put a lot of time and energy into this. We know what we're doing with this. However, what we really ultimately want to get out of it is that we see the data collected and collected right and processed and made available to everyone. Because certainly what this is that it's invaluable public information, and ultimately that's it. Now, we always have a vested interest. As you can see, the bare earth data will improve our mapping, will help us with accelerating our performance measures and our programs. So I can't say that we're so altruistic on this that we don't have an idea in mind here, and that's for us. So with that, and we have other things we can show you on this, but it's certainly be willing to answer any questions or comments.
Thank you, and it's really exciting to hear about this as somebody who has worked on remote sensing for 25 years and started out with stereoscopes. It gives me chills to see what's available. With that said, I also, a couple of questions I have for you. One is, you talked about the, and if I may, I'll make sure I do follow up. You talked about using a contractor for this. Is that correct? That worked on the Puget Sound project?
Senator Devlin and Representative Dingfelder, yes. We are presently working through the Puget Sound Consortium for this 2,100 square miles we're collecting this time around. And what that buys us is it's their RFP. It's their RFP, so we did not have to let the RFP on that. And they are processing, they do the processing and the QAQC. So it is a pretty good deal this time around for the amount that we're collecting.
And just a quick follow-up, so we would be, that's what I was trying, my question was, are we going through a competitive bid process, and then have you built in the QAQC and your staff time to oversee the contractor? And it sounds like you're going to piggyback on to the contract that already is with the state of Washington?
Well, what we've been describing is our proposal, which is one thing, and then what we're actually doing, which is another. What we've been doing is this description of the 2,100 square miles and how we're working with the Puget Sound Ladder Consortium. The intent with the, if Oregon wants to take it on, and frankly the Puget Sound Ladder Consortium has told us, is that they're not particularly interested in doing this magnitude of work for Oregon at a deep discount. So in our model, and all the details not been worked out, is that it would be independent RFP process with QAQC either subcontracted to another party, possibly to parts of the Oregon University system, or hire that expertise, and through, again, a subcontracting process. The FTE would be a combination of predominantly technical skills and intimate knowledge of the system, so that the RFP is designed right. You know, if you don't get good data, you know, you get garbage. And so the our recommendation was to have that FDE be the lead party, both technically and administratively, on the contracting of the data. The rest of the agency, we would absorb certainly the activity that is involved in this, you know, for accounting and overall oversight, and that we're actually not even requesting because we already have those capabilities.
Follow up. I absolutely support this. I mean, for somebody who, you know, the information out there is woefully inadequate, especially when we're looking at development projects and making sure that we're, making sure that we're not developing in areas that are of high hazard and protecting, you know, health and human safety and deferring costs in the future with landslides or erosion, whatever. The other question I have, and two things. One is OWEB should be an integral partner of this because there's 90 watershed councils working around the state that are doing watershed assessments. I hired consultants, digitized information, and 110 data layers for the Tualatin. You know, this would have been phenomenal, especially when we're looking at riparian and canopy cover areas and doing restoration projects. So question is, will this be available through maybe a fee? And that's sort of my next part of my question is, are you going to put together sort of a cost recovery plan? Because, you know, I can see firms like mine wanting to use this data, but, of course, we'd be willing to pay for it. Also partners that would be willing to pay for it. So you would have a cost recovery plan to recover some of these costs. You know, Metro does that now. Metro has fee-for-service, and anybody who uses Metro GIS information pays for it. So have you? Is that sort of the next step that you're going to look at a cost recovery? Because I think that certainly should be part of the equation.
Senator Devlin and Representative Dingfelder and committees, that is, again, one of the models that could be considered with this. We weren't keen on making it a it really depends on how we develop this. Say it went out as a COP, and again, that this is just a rhetorical, and there certainly then has to be debt service paid on that COP. It has been one of the discussions is maybe you could do some type of fee recovery on that. We have to be very careful with that because we're a public entity, and there, you know, right now all we can do is recover some of. For example, we sell our publications, but we sell them at a very reduced price because we're not even beginning to recover the cost of those. And we really are not in a position of where we can make money on that. Even so. That's tricky. Now, I'm not saying it's not, you know, that's not an idea, and there are ways that we could work with that, but I wouldn't want to do that completely. If we went to some type of, for example, with the data that we are collecting now, since we are leveraging funds and going with shared data, I would think that would become public information because we're sharing the cost, spreading that across all of these different entities.
Can I just clarify? I'm not talking about complete 100% cost recovery, but for instance, you know, a private company for a city that wants to access this data, that it's going to be way more cost effective. You know, we're not going to go collect LIDAR on our own or even contract with somebody to do it, but, you know, you're providing a service, and it's sort of a fee for service, at least partially. It's really valuable information that only the state is going to have at this point. So it's just something to think about.
Could we add one comment to that, Chair Devlin?
There are practical difficulties to a cost recovery program. For example, in Clackamas County, during the investigation and development of the city of Damascus, high-resolution LIDAR data was acquired. That data is currently available on a fee or cost recovery basis. The problem is that even the rest of Metro doesn't work for them. So, for example, that area is being reflown this year, so that information will be public domain and readily available to everyone. The federal government, with their involvement in this, they insist that there is no cost recovery. They will only participate in 100% public domain data sets.
I might interject on this, is that my memory is correct. When Metro had a number of these projects where they're attempting to recover part of the cost of producing the data, they came to the legislature and actually got an amendment to state law that actually allows to not consider it the same as you would consider other public information. So,
Chair Devlin,
Metro does it.
Yes.
So that's why I'm curious how.
Right. Right. There is something on the books about the cost recovery for remote sense data too. We have to. I would actually, if the chair would permit, I need to clarify a comment I made about the length of the COP. And if I could ask Mr. Siebert, if you could clarify that. I believe I misstated on the length of that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the COPs would be completed, the payments would be completed in the 2013-2015 biennium, so they'd be sold, I believe, under the plan in May of 2008 and then March of 2009, two sales. The debt service this biennium is only $116,000 general fund. But then the cost in 2009-11 would be $2.1 million. So it's a significant roll-up cost because you're not paying really just a little bit of the debt service this biennium. The full cost starts to phase in next biennium. And then it would be around that much. It would be $2.1 million in 2009-11 and 2011-13, and then going down to just a million in 2013-2015. So probably about 5 years.
Total.
Yep, roughly about $1 million in interest.
Yep, about $1 million in interest, that's right.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, for allowing us to clarify that. I did not want to misstate on that.
Senator Walken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Gingfelter started to get to the issue that I guess I've been thinking about as you go through this. I need you to talk a little bit more about the value of the technology relative to what you've been using. In this respect, I would liken it to like the old tube TVs, color TVs, to HDTV, where one of them obviously gives you better technology and a better picture, but the truth is you get the information both ways, and even though one is better. And so the increased specificity of your mapping with this gives you more information, but what is it about that additional information that is beneficial to whoever is using it above what you had before? Did I say that clearly enough that you follow me?
Chair Devlin and says Representative Nolan, but yeah. We'll put that way. I know. Senator Avant, absolutely. I'm going to make a stab at this at the beginning, and I believe Mr. Lewis will want to follow up a little bit. But really, and Mr. Lewis did refer to this, is these are data. They're X, Y, and Z. So you have the X and the Y, so you have all your location. You have the Z that have the vertical. So it's 3 points in space that are very accurately collected. So with those data, you can create all these different profiles that are very accurate and very real. The data are then, as Mr. Lewis said, you're able to interrogate it directly. You can directly build stream profiles. You can directly locate where landslide scarps are, where earthquake fault scarps are underneath the blackberry bushes that you can't see. You couldn't map on the ground if you wanted to. So the other information is really taking two-dimensional information and trying to turn it into three-dimensional information. You simply are not directly collecting three-dimensional information.
Actually, one thing about something you just said, when you said you can't map it on the ground even if you wanted to, does that mean you're getting information here that you would not get even if you sent people out in the field to experience it firsthand?
Senator Devlin and Senator Avakian, that is correct. And a perfect example of that is what this was used for initially in Puget Sound in the Seattle area was the USGS were conducting an earthquake hazard assessment for the Puget Sound in Seattle area. And it's very similar to here, lots of blackberry bushes and infestations of ivy, and it's material that makes it very difficult for a field person to go out there and actually walk on the ground and look at contacts and map it. However, when you strip all that information off, you can see very subtle fault scarps. They were actually picking up fault scarps that were only 6 or 8 inches. You would never see that walking out on the surface. Even the best geologist would have missed that.
I just one other comment, Chair, if I could, which
respond to if you want, but you don't need to. I was very pleased to hear your the way you stated the response to Representative Dingler's question about how this can be used for, you know, fee generation and such. Because one of the great concerns I have is that as our university system and as government becomes more and more involved in the not just the application but the research of technology like this, is that it potentially puts the government in competition with private business for certain things, in which it has never been the place of government, at least in our type of government. And especially as budgets get squeezed through lack of general fund dollars, it becomes almost a matter of necessity for some agencies to make money off the things that they do for the public. And so just for the record, you don't need to comment, but I was pleased about your answer, which showed me caution, an understanding and a caution in approaching this technology in that way.
Chair Devlin and Senator Avakian, thank you very much. And we are cautious, and we wouldn't have brought this forward if we didn't think that it was something that we think that the state would really, really benefit from.
I have Representative Burley, then Representative Clem, and Representative Garrard also. I'll go Garrard, Burley, Clem.
Or it's age before beauty. In your presentation, you make the request for one FTE, which I heard Mr. Lewis briefly describe in his response to the representative was kind of a combination administrative technical fix. But I was somewhat caught back at $140,000 for that one FTE. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that one FTE a little bit.
Well, that one FTE, I believe, it's in the information specialist series. I believe it was an ISS 6, possibly 7 level. The way we requested the budget is at step 2 of that position. That position description actually does describe that level and nature of activity as being this kind of person that we're looking for. We have some of those people on staff. This is at a higher level than that. We're requested to estimate the initial cost at step 2, irregardless of where the market would say you could hire such a person. So that number is taken off the state's scale for that position.
And Senator Chair Devlin and Representative Garrard, that number, any time that you're looking at the FTE numbers, that is both the salary and the OPE. So that's the complete package of what it costs for that position. So they're not paid $140,000. I'm not sure what their scale is, but that covers their whole benefit package, and that's how all FTEs are calculated.
That's over 2 years, of course, so that'd be $70,000 a year, of which a third of that would be benefits. So the person would be probably, if we were successful in hiring a person like that, which is debatable, probably start at around $44,000, which is
not a lot.
Representative Burley, and then Representative Clem, and then we're going to go to the public hearing.
The discussion about how to fund this acquisition, notwithstanding, one of the values of tools like this is the ability to go back out subsequent years, especially in the case of landslides. So what sort of time period would you envision revisiting this 10,000 square miles or even just subsets of it, and what kind of a cost structure would that entail?
Chair Devlin and Representative Burley, that's an excellent question. In other words, what's the shelf life of information like this? And that varies. Certainly, the overall collection would be good for at least a decade. Now, there may be, as you said, subsets of areas where you would want to revisit it more frequently. The Mount Hood area and Highway 35 and ODOT, I'm sure, will want some subsets in that they will be interested in, why they joined in with our initial collection this year is because of the debris flow activity that happened off of Highway 35 in the White River. They want to develop a baseline now so that they're certainly, and they have some serious issues of what to do with that highway up there. So The big answer is we're looking at least a decade of shelf life for the full package, but certainly there will be subsets of that, just like flying aerial photos or updating topographic maps. There'll be areas that are having more development that may want to revisit. We haven't built that into this program. We really have come forward with a proposal to get this baseline information collected.
Cool. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, based on the two-dimensional images that we're looking at, it seems to me all of this is being done on the west side of the Cascades. Do you have any plans to do anything on the east side?
Chair Devlin and Representative Burley, certainly, because we allude to this being statewide and we're not west side centric at all, the reality is because of the vegetation coverage on the west side, it is the area that this will be the most beneficial initially. You can still collect very good data from aerial photography on the east side where you have less vegetation because you're not estimating as much. Now, does that mean we don't want to do it? No, we'd love to have come forward with a suggestion for the entire state, but that would really be cost prohibitive.
That triggered a follow-up, if I may. Well, yes, granted, but aerial photography, if I'm not mistaken, you don't have the same ability to interrogate.
Senator Devlin and Representative Burr, that's correct. You don't have that three-dimensional data. And we wanted to come forward with a proposal that we thought would be palatable and we could discuss based on the cost of this right now. But in the long run, absolutely, we'd like to see these kind of data from the entire state. There's issues. I mean, there are faults. There are landslides. There are watershed issues. There's certainly groundwater. There's plenty of issues on the east side where maybe there's a little less forest cover, but just as many issues.
Representative Burley, the cost estimate for all the 17,610 square miles of those blue areas would be approximately $9 million. So that'd be the cost to acquire all those urban, near-urban infrastructure corridors that were identified on that figure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clement, then we will go to public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At one point, I think I had heard kind of a built-in philosophy of part of why you want the data where you want it, A, vegetation, those types of issues, but B, where people are, that activities are occurring that may very well affect health and safety and development, a lot of building, and certainly I would think Central Oregon is a place where that would qualify to meet that criteria because there's a lot of people placing homes and other things. And I can't remember in your 10,000 acres if there is anything at all east, including Bend, Redmond, Madras. That might be something for us to think about as a committee. Because
right.
Anytime we visit Representative Burley's area, I think all of us know that that's real. I had one question about water. Because of the technology, anything below the surface of the water just reflects back up, and you couldn't, examine the ocean and the dead zones. I mean, you get nothing really there.
Senator Devlin, Chair, and Representative Klim, yes, that's a very good question. It does reflect off water, and there is a type of LIDAR that can collect under very shallow water, but we're not advocating this. For the information that you're looking for, you really need the bathymetry, which again is the topography of the ocean floor, and that's collected by a different technology.
Mr. Chair, one more?
Yes.
And this is more of a comment that I think is reflected in Representative Dingfelder and Senator Vakian's comments. I believe very much in basic science, just for the sake of basic science. I think it's very important that not everything is tailored around commercial interests, but I think most members of the public generally agree that, and there's lots of examples over this, whether it's pharmaceutical companies and basic science developing Taxol from the Pacific U and then not knowing how to, as it became in the market, the scientists don't necessarily care. They were interested in the solutions. But the representatives and senators looking at the bill for basic science and seeing people making billions of dollars off it do sort of care. Same thing as we're trying to develop all these nanotechnology that the universities are doing, and how do you bring that to market and patents. So I share the philosophical ring that it's worth doing it. It's just when somebody is using it like a hunter or a hiker is using it to go walk around and enjoy nature and see where they're going to go, that's one thing. When there's a company, their whole specialty is making an income, and I don't fault them for making the income, but making the income off the public's data, I would like to see them sharing it, because it's a commercial activity. It's not just a public use, so it's not really the public domain. And how you do that exactly, I'm not sure, but I feel strongly that there's a philosophical rooting that's important there that isn't just about cost either.
Chair Devlin.
Comment short, because we
have to get the public. Right. Chair Devlin and Representative Clement, and that's very true. And one thing I do want to stress is that we do not, we the agency are very careful that we don't move into basic science. We consider ourselves a science-based agency, but it's very practical. And even this, what we're bringing forward to you, are how will there be practical uses for this. And I completely agree from a scientific point of view, but I think it's very clear that state agencies should be in the practical science business. So thank you. And thank you very much for the great questions on this.
At this particular point, first of all, let me state for the record, it's already been stated that the LIDAR portion of this budget is going to be broken out, and there will be a later decision on that. So there will be a lot of time for us to, maybe not as much in terms of our time here in committee, but to have a lot of these questions answered. I'm sure that Ms. McConnell and her staff will be available. I'm sure a lot of other people will be available in terms of trying to answer some of these questions, and there are a wide host of questions. We're going to move to public testimony now, since we have about 10 minutes left. And so what we will do is, first of all, Mr. Siebert will read into the record the names of individuals that have submitted written testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, you have at your places a packet of materials in support of the Dogami budget. There are three letters from the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness asking for a consideration of funding specific products, including accelerating tsunami inundation mapping, implementing the seismic safety rehabilitation program that was contained in Senate Bill 3, and requesting funding for seismic instrumentation to be added to the Dogami budget. You have a letter from the Morrill County Planning Department requesting consideration and positive consideration of Dogami's budget. You have a letter from Pacific Hydrogeology, Inc. That's in support of the Dogami budget, their proposed budget. You also have a letter from a number of individuals, including Dixie Meadow Ranch, Crooked River Watershed Council, OSU County Extension, that deal with the department's Baker office, supporting the office presence and the work that they do.
With that, I'll ask Mr. Engstrom to come forward, and I'm going to ask both parties that are speaking to limit their testimony to no more than 3 minutes.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Rich Engstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. We represent 90-95% of the aggregate production in the state, and probably 30-40% of the state operators. Overall, I just wanted to talk about the budget and program too, and how things have been going from the industry's perspective the program two portion. We spent a lot of time working with Dogami and feel like the program's running pretty well. There has been a few issues around the state where we've had some operators that have been doing things that they haven't been doing. We've been working pretty closely with the department on making sure, self-policing basically in some ways, but making sure that the laws and our industry behaves well. One of the things that is important to you is last time around we had a pretty big fee bill that went through, and we believe that the fee bill is functioning pretty well. We think at the end of this biennium, we created a subcount, if folks will remember. We set the fee bait high enough that we thought that there would be some extra money that would be able to be set aside as kind of, for lack of a better term, a rainy day fund for the industry, because what we were experiencing with the program too was kind of a peak and valley as the production, the aggregate production in the state kind of went up and down. It was making it pretty hard for the department to program to function. And so we supported that and got that through last time. There are a few things that we still need to define as how much we're going to put in the sub-account, when it gets to a point that that's enough and we need to readjust the fees downward, when we're going to have access to it and what we're going to have access to it for, you know, what kind of needs the department might need, and those could include studies or during a recession to augment the income, which is really what it was designed for. One of the points I did want to make is the fee was robust enough that it has been picking up a portion of the obligation of the oil and gas industry, and we know that, and we've been okay with that, knowing that the oil and gas people have stepped up this time with a fee bill to try to basically pick up their own costs that they incur on program too. With that, I just am open for questions.
Yes, one question, and then we will have to go to the next person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Angstrom, I was curious if you might want to comment on KPM-5, the chart, the questions that we'd asked earlier about why 2000, and I think it was 2 and 3, had kind of that sharp spike, if what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I agreed with, Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, I agreed with Gary Lynch on that particular one, but to expand just a little bit on it so it's clearer. Dogami changed. We insure our bonding and with different insurance companies, and with some changes in the bonding requirements, the cost went up significantly to do that. In some places, some of the miners felt they weren't going to be able to one, survive the increase, or two, get these insurance companies basically to insure the bond. And so what happened was, is in order to make that work, a lot of the operators reclaimed what they had already mined. And I think you saw a big spike during that 2000 period as they tried to reduce their bond debt and that they were going to pay. And so I think it worked out pretty well. It worked out for the environment, worked out for the operators. They ended up paying less, and it was how that all kind of fleshed out in a way that everything kept functioning well. But so you saw that big increase.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Angstrom. Mr. Bella, also you'll have 3 minutes. And I would point out that Mr. Bella has also provided written testimony.
Yes. My name is James Bela. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm also president and founder of Oregon Earthquake Awareness. I have advanced master's degree in both civil geotechnical engineering and also geology. I guess we'll have LIDAR if you give them the means, but I have a big caveat. I believe the LIDAR is being oversold to you, and in 3 minutes I don't have time to go into it, but feel free to ask me a question. But the major benefit we need to find out on LIDAR is if we can find surface faults that we've been missing. In Puget Sound, they showed up, and they were much more than 6 inches because I've been to the exposures. Because of their length, they show up like a knife dragged across the frosting on a wedding cake. So I would recommend maybe a urban Portland area to dovetail with the USGS maps. Somebody told me once, if you're going to criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. Then when you do criticize them, you'll be a mile away and you'll have their shoes. I believe there's some fundamental changes that are required to bring the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industry, a so-called independent agency, more into line with serving the public good. And here's the background. I wrote this to Governor Kulongoski to articulate some serious concerns about a state agency, the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I believe their ineffective and arrogant actions, which have revolved around securing agency funding, have made Oregonians less safe from natural hazards, particularly earthquakes, than the logical conclusions from the years and now decades of scientific research would reasonably dictate. Nowhere is this more clearly evident than in Delgami's usurpation of a truly structural engineering and building codes division expertise, that is, the seismic safety of existing buildings. By this action, which they promoted into statute in the 2001 Senate Bill 1415 and 2005 Senate Bills 2-3 legislative sessions, they have continued to ignore and continue to enable the weakening of the earthquake building codes for new construction in our state. And this is occurring by the deliberately neglectful and politically motivated Building Codes Division, which adopts them under the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Bella, I'm not going to cut you off, but I actually need you to paraphrase. We probably don't have time to read the entire letter into the record, so 3 minutes. I think at this stage it would take another five just to get through the letter.
Well, someone once said the answer is money. What is the question? The issue is, for more than 30 years, this agency has survived by writing themselves into the statutory language and then saying, look, this is our mission. We need to do this. Give us the money. Come back to the e-board. And there are several problems with this. They're not accountable for the special scientific knowledge they possess. The public took the leadership in getting the seismic zonation for the earthquake building code for new construction passed. There's a letter from Delgami. They were kind of pressured to agree that it was a good idea in the public hearing. They wrote one letter. Then the representative who chaired the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Commission would not even reveal to the commission when the issue was discussed that that was the agency's policy. So they just have never been able to be counted upon when you need them for any meaningful effort. The landslide issues, it's interesting. 30 years ago, the department published the geologic hazard studies of Oregon City. And in that, it detailed the landslide issues and said, these are the rock units that have this problem. When Oregon City developed those houses that were in the slide, Scott Burns from Portland State and Bill Burns, who was a PSU student, is now with the department, and a public person, Sherry Patterson, went to the Clackamas County and testified that it was not a good idea. And they built them anyway. And where was the department? You know, they put the information out. Nobody uses it. There's nothing. The building code is the law of the land. We can't even get them to support having an up-to-date building code. So I think, you know, LIDAR is nice, but in my view, this is fluff and puff, these key performance measures. I don't know how you can take that stuff seriously. The Oregon would be better served if we had county geologists in each county working with the building community. The problem with the department, we can't get a Geologic Hazards Mapping Act like they have in California that actually is law of the land that requires you to take a concrete action. Now, they did this county geologic hazard study 30 years ago. 30 years now, they want to remorph themselves into the LIDAR consortium. They're overselling that, particularly in terms of tsunami. It's supposed to cure everything. I would focus on where the USGS is mapping in the urban area, answer the question, can we find surface traces of active fault before we jump into doing the whole state?
Thank you very much, Ms. Pellin. Thank you.
Ms. McConnell, I'll give you 1 minute to close on your budget. If there's anything that you'd like to respond to here in another way, please do it in writing. Make sure it's made available to the committee staff and to Mr. Bella or any other parties that you might be commenting on.
Chair Devlin and committee members, for the record, I'm Vicki McConnell with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And two quick points. On the budget, I appreciate the questions and the work, and I would very much appreciate if we all form an active group to develop a workable model for collecting the LIDAR. And just quickly to reply to Mr. Bela's comments, I absolutely agree that we should be looking in the urban and metro area, and that's exactly why we are collecting the LIDAR this year in the Portland and metro area to answer those questions. So that is the beginning of that work. Our idea is that why do it again as a postage stamp? Let's just go ahead and deal with those issues in the rest of the state as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and we will be acting on the budget sometime, I think, in the near future, and probably on the LIDAR portion, probably a couple of months later in the session.
Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned.